that at that time, not talking about the Mahayana teachings of the Bodhisattva, the main emphasis was talking about the emptiness of the person, or selflessness. Anatta, in Pali. In Sanskrit, it's anatma. Have you heard the word atma? What does atma mean, Joy? Soul or self. We think, like, if we think of Hinduism, they often would be translated as soul, or in Christianity, it would be like equivalent to soul. But it also just means the sense of self. I mentioned in one of the other talks, one of the great Christian theologians, philosophers, way back when, I don't know who was that, St. Thomas Aquinas or someone, said, there's no need to prove the existence of the soul. This is so obvious. You didn't have to have some philosophical, you know, proof. It was just so. I think what he was talking about was this appearance to our mind of the self, the soul, the atma. So, like the echo, which was empty of dog, okay, empty of some source that my mind was imagining there, like a reflection of myself in the mirror that I might see out of the corner of my eye and think there's another monk over there. It's actually empty of monk. Something's appearing, but it's empty of that. Like that, this self appears, but is empty of what our mind is imagining there. It's like our mind saying, oh yeah, that's there. There's a real I. There's a real Joey. There's a real Dave. There's a real Karen. There's a real, you know, Joan. There's a real Laura. I forgot your guys' names. What are your names? They're from Germany. Alex and Sandra. Oh, Alexandra. Oh my God. That's like the toilets at Copan. Sam and Sarah. Samsara. So you're Alexandra. Okay. That's nice. So to each of you, and to, when we view other people, we have a sense of the real reality of them somehow, especially if we're longing for them or if we're angry at them. It's like there's something real there. Not just their body or mind, it's like some real soulness. And in our own sense, too, in the more fundamental teachings of Buddha, the Buddha was teaching anatma. There is no, that atma that appears to us is actually doesn't exist the way our mind is believing it to exist, as though there's something behind it, real, findable. Just like the mirage, like the echo and so forth, it's empty of that inherent existence. Here's a new word. Is in this text here, Joey, inherent existence is Rangshin Gi Tongba. Rangshin means nature. Gi is an instrumental particle. Tongpa means empty. Empty by or of an inherent nature. Rangshin. Or svabhava.
Did you say tongpa?
Tongpa. T-O-N-G. It has a S superfix above it. So he was meditating not only on the emptiness of the self, he was meditating on the emptiness of the five aggregates also. So what does that mean? For the practitioners of the Buddha's basic teachings, the main thing that they meditated on was the emptiness of the self. They thought the self was just labeled onto these five aggregates, the body, the mind, the feelings, and so forth. But come on, those five aggregates really exist. For their point of view. What do I mean by that? Let me ask you, between a tree and a forest, does one of them seem to be more substantial to you? What is a forest? A collection of trees. Can you find the forest other than the trees?
You need trees.
You need trees, right, to have a forest. Even if you go to some place that's called something forest, and it's just a, you know, there's some places that may be called that, where there was a great battle or something, you know, the trees are no longer there, but it still has the name forest. So in Buddhist philosophy, we talk about things which are substantially existent and things which are just labeled or imputedly existent, two categories. In, according to the lower philosophical view, a tree is something that has its own substantial existence. You can see it just by itself. But you can't see and apprehend a forest without apprehending something else, the trees. Because the tree is just something you label to that collection of trees. Did I say it right? The forest is just something you label to a collection of trees. How about an army and soldiers? The soldiers would be, from a point of view, you could see the individual soldiers or their horses and the chariots, the various things of the army. But army is labeled onto that collection of soldiers and horses and howitzers or whatever in the older times, maybe something else. Army is imputedly existent, imputed onto the individual, substantially existent soldiers, you might say. Rosary. Do anyone have a rosary here? You know Mala? Yeah, no, Donna's got. She's got to pull out from her special rosary pouch here. Okay. So the beads of the rosary, to this lower philosophical view, all have their own substantial existence. You know, you can see that each individual bead. But when they're strung up with a string in that particular way, we label that collection of parts, we impute upon that collection of parts the name rosary or garland. Okay? Don't tire your arm. You don't have to hold it up. I just thought it would be good, just so people know what we're talking about. So from the lower philosophical point of view, the person is just imputedly existent on this collection of parts, but the parts themselves, they say, are substantially existent, just like the trees, the soldiers, the beads. You get some feeling of what I'm saying? So from a higher philosophical point of view, even the tree, if you take apart the tree, it has many parts. The tree is actually imputed upon the collection of parts, on the branches, the leaves, the fruit, the roots, and even the branches imputed upon its parts. And any one of those parts that you broke it up to is also, you know, like the place where it joins the trunk, whatever that might be called, that also is imputed on its parts, down to the smallest thing. So from the higher philosophical view, even the basis upon which we're labeling the person, the five aggregates, that is also empty of inherent existence. That's why the word also is in here, Joey, where I said on that, whatever that was, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, actually the eighth line down where I said the word arya, pakpa, chenrezi is, on the next line, the ninth line, it says, I'm trying to find the word yang here. Sherabhi Paruti Chimpa Tashing Pungpo Ngakpo Derak Layang Rangshing Gi Tongpa Tongpa O. So they are also, those five aggregates are also empty of inherent nature. So this comes as a shock to the lower philosophical view. So this is what he's doing. Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha sitting there meditating on the conventional and ultimate nature of phenomena, on Vulture's Peak, surrounded by all these people. Avalokiteshvara, this great bodhisattva, is meditating on the perfection of wisdom, and he's understanding the five aggregates also as empty of inherent existence. Not just that the person is empty of inherent existence. Okay? Get some feeling? So then, dene, sangye yitu, they said, then, by the power of the Buddha, the inspiration of the Buddha, the venerable Shariputra. You know who Shariputra was? One of the main disciples of the Buddha? I mentioned in one of the other talks, and you may know anyway, of the many disciples that the Buddha had, he always mentioned to them, you know, that Alexander was the foremost in German chocolate, and Alessandra is the foremost in German fashion, or Donna is the foremost in, you know, organizing centers, and, you know, different people had different qualities. Shariputra was the foremost of the Buddha's disciples in wisdom, but of the lower wisdom, not the bodhisattva wisdom. He was what's called a hearer or shravaka, someone who heard the Buddha's teachings to achieve enlightenment, to achieve nirvana, put them into practice. Once he achieved that, he caused others to hear that. Those kind of people were called shravakas. Etymology, shravaka means hearer. Those who hear the teachings, put it into practice, and then cause others to hear about their own realizations that they can do it also. So at that time, by the power, the inspiration of the Buddha, the venerable Shariputra says to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, this is what he said. He said, hey, Avalokiteshvara, it's not in the sutra, it's just he's talking to Avalokiteshvara, how should any son of the lineage, Rikipu, do you know what that is, Joy? Rikipu? Rik means lineage or family. Pu means son or child. In India, if you were born to the royal lineage, if you were a prince, you would be called the son of the lineage. So Kulaputra in Sanskrit. So here he's saying, how should any son of the lineage, meaning how should anyone who is of the Mahayana lineage, who's developed bodhicitta and wants to become a Buddha practicing the bodhisattva path, how should any son of the lineage practice? Rikipu, Kanglala, Sherabgi Parutu Chimpa, Sabmo Chopa, Chopa Dopa De, Chita Labaja. How should they train? How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to course or to practice the profound perfection of wisdom, the bodhisattva wisdom? So Shariputra is expert in wisdom of the lesser teachings. At lunch we were talking that the Hinayana, some people don't like to use the word Hinayana nowadays because it sounds pejorative, like the Mahayana, if we practice the Mahayana, we're superior, the great vehicle, and the Hinayana is a lesser vehicle or something. But this actually, the Buddha used that word in his own discourses sometime. He said, anyone with great wisdom, great aspiration, shouldn't be satisfied with my, that means the Buddha's, Hinayana teachings, my lesser vehicle teachings, like just like a chariot that takes you to your destination. They should practice my Mahayana, my great vehicle. So I think I told you the story, some of you may have heard before, when I came to Asheville many, many years ago, and I'd seen, I was giving a course here, one lady had been designated as my driver. Did I tell this story before? She was a florist in Asheville, and she had a Cadillac hearse that she used as her delivery thing. An old, you know what a hearse is? Where you carry the bodies to the funerals. A big, long Cadillac, you know, very somber color. So I was getting into the front seat. She was driving, and she said, with her Asheville accent, she said, I call this the Mahayana, the great vehicle. As opposed to a little Fiat or something like that, right? Or as opposed to Susie's, what is yours called, Susie? Keyless, yeah, a little more, but it's quite spacious inside. So, Avalokiteshvara was a practitioner of the Buddha's great vehicle, the Mahayana. Shariputra was the foremost amongst the practitioners of the Hinayana in wisdom. But he's asking Avalokiteshvara, hey, how do you bodhisattvas? I know how we are supposed to practice as shravakas, as hearers, to achieve our nirvana, the wisdom that we need to get out. We meditate on anatta, anatma, the selflessness. How do you bodhisattvas train? So Avalokiteshvara says, he said that, and the bodhisattva, mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, said in return, and here it uses another name for Shariputra, his longer name, it says, Sedandemba Shari Dvati Putra. So Shariputra, putra means son. Shariputra means son of Shari, his mom. Mom's name was Shari. The longer name, Sharitvati Putra, is somehow, I don't remember exactly when you talk about genealogy, it's somehow delineating the mother's other part of her family or something. So it's all, that's a more formal name for Shariputra. So he says to Shariputra, basically, remember what Shariputra, he said, how should any son of the lineage who wants to practice the perfection of wisdom train? Now, in answer to that, Avalokiteshvara says, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage should train in this way. So in some of the sutras, some of the versions of the sutra from the very beginning, it sounds like Shariputra is asking, how should any son or daughter of the lineage practice? But here, this is one common way that it is written. Implication is that in the Theravada tradition, more sense that in order to achieve nirvana in this lifetime, you have to have a male body. Some precedence is given to the male. Nowadays, that's like, won't accept that, right? We're woke. And in fact, here, Avalokiteshvara is kind of, if you read it this way, Avalokiteshvara is kind of throwing it back in the face of Shariputra. He says, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage, for that matter, who wants to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should look at it like this. Sharavki paruta chimpa sabma choba choba doba te dita nampa tawa jate. They should look at it like this. Pumpong nakpo derak kyang. Kyang means also. Rangshin gi tongpa is empty of inherent nature. They should yang dakpa perfectly. Yang dakpa means perfect. Jesu tongpa. They should subsequently look again and again at perfectly at the emptiness of the five aggregates also. Not just as you, Shariputra, are used to just looking at the emptiness of the self, thinking that it's imputedly existent, but the aggregates exist. Even those aggregates are empty of inherent existence. Like I said before, if you look at the forest, someone says, well, the trees substantially exist, but the forest is just imputed upon them. You might agree at first, but then you say, well, aren't the trees imputed on its parts, like we were saying before? So this is what Avalokiteshvara is saying. All phenomena, not just the self of persons, even the things that the self is imputed on, and all other phenomena are all empty of inherent existence. Pungpong ngakpo, tera kyang, rangshengi, tongpa nampa, yangdakpa, jesu tao. So this is a very famous statement. Now, the next four phrases are enshrined in many people's minds. Sometimes you see, if you say the Heart Sutra, people always say, here it says, suk tongpao, tongpa ni sukso, suk le tongpa ni shenmayin, tongpa ni le kyang, Sukshen Mayino. This is sometimes called the fourfold profundity. a philosophical analysis. What it says, so you know what it's saying? You're already saying, uh-huh. What were you thinking? What is he saying? Form is empty.
Emptiness is
form.
Emptiness is
form is not other than emptiness. And emptiness is not other than form. Four statements, okay? Sometimes called the fourfold profundity. Sometimes people think that's the whole sutra. In the so the version that we have here is the longest version of this sutra that's preserved in the Tibetan canon, also in Sanskrit. In Japanese, their version leaves off some of the preamble here. The Buddha was at Vulture's Peak and this and that happened and so forth. It just maybe starts from this point. Sometimes the sutra is shorter. Also in Chinese, there are various editions that are shorter than this. This version that we have is considered, you know, like the full Monty. Can I say that? Just joking. You saw this same movie, right? I think there was some movie about these guys who, in Britain or something, they would take off their clothes or something like that, the full Mountie. So, anyway, just joking. So after he's told Shariputra, the Shariputra says, how do you bodhisattvas meditate on the perfection of wisdom? Implication is, I know how we meditate as hearers, how do you guys do it? And Avalokiteshvara tells him, we meditate, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to engage in this should look at it like this, correctly and subsequently viewing those five aggregates also, not just the person, as empty of inherent existence. And then he says, form is empty, emptiness is form, form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. So what is this thing? Form, not only the self is empty, like when we gave the example of the echo is empty of dog, or the mirage is empty of water, right? You agreed we could stretch the use of the word empty that way. You'd understand what I meant if I said that. A reflection is empty of what you think is there. A person who's like a parrot. Do any of you have parakeet who looks at its reflection in the mirror and is talking to it all day long, or canary or something like that? So it may be when the brain is small enough, when the wisdom is small enough, you continue to mistake, you know, the reflection to have some real meaning. Another bird is there. But it's actually empty of another bird, right? It's your own reflection. So, not only is the person empty, form is empty. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. So, you might think, okay, this phenomena that we're calling the emptiness of the form, the lack of the form existing the way that it appears. Say, like, let's say the conventional form. Its other hand is what our mind imagines there, immediately superimposed on it. Let's say this is Joey, dressed up as Santa Claus. This is the imagination of the kids or his nephews or kids looking at Joey dressed up as Santa Claus, imputing on him, imagining that that's really Santa Claus. Okay? Actually, I don't want to disappoint you, but actually Joey is empty of actual Santa Claus. Right? But to the kids, uneducated in let's say higher reality, they believe what is appearing to their mind. To someone who's seen, knows that that's Joey, still it appears that. It appears that, like, he's Santa Claus, he's got a good outfit, but they know that this superimposition isn't really there. They've experienced emptiness. When they see the conventional reality, it still appears as though it's Santa Claus, but they know, come on, it's just Joey. Don't worry. There's no Santa Claus. You get it? So, the understanding that this combination of the conventional joy and the projection of Santa Claus on it, the understanding that, that this projection doesn't exist there is something you don't perceive with your eye. It's something you know with your mind. It's the wisdom that realizes emptiness, that the appearance, the reality of the appearance is not really there. And to that mind, all that appears to that mind is a vacuity, an emptiness. You don't think of joy, you don't think of Santa Claus, you're not thinking of anything else. Or if you're talking about the emptiness of form, form does not appear to your mind when you're realizing the emptiness of form. Just the mere absence, just a mere vacuity, which has been induced by your wisdom that investigated this, that came to the conclusion, there is no inherently existent form. At that point, all that's appearing to your mind is the mere absence of inherently existence, inherent existence. That doesn't mean inherent existence kind of is lingering there in your mind. All that appears is a vacuity. Subsequently, when you rise from that, you realize that you just realized, you understand that you've just realized that there is no inherent Santa Claus there, no inherent form within the conventional form. So that understanding, so you say emptiness, is that something that exists separate from the form itself? Or the emptiness of joy being Santa Claus, is that phenomena, that emptiness that we just experienced, is it something that exists separate from joy, dressed up as Santa Claus? Here, Avalokiteshvara is saying, form is empty, emptiness is form. The very entity of form and its emptiness, remember, let's say, form, conventional form, just the name form, our mind imputes upon it some kind of findability, as like there was real form back there. Not just the name. But then in addition to that, that's the conventional reality of form. You okay? Yeah. Live streaming? Yeah. The conventional form, the projection of inherent existence, the understanding that this inherent existence, the appearance of the inherent existence, isn't really there. That understanding is what we call emptiness. It's not like that understanding of emptiness is something else out here. That is one nature with the form. Like the example of the medallion, you know. Like very kindly, my hosts, David and Karen, bought some Medaglio d'Oro. Is that a good pronunciation? Good enough. I'm not Italian, good Italian. Medaglio d'Oro means gold medallion, right? Gold medal. So a medallion maybe has, like a coin, has a front side and a back side. Maybe there's some writing on the back, like the tail of a coin and picture of the king of Italy or one time or something on the other side. So the tail of a coin or the head, the face side of the medallion and the back side, they form one entity. You can't separate them. If you want to argue, you can cut it down the side so you have the head and the tail separately. It's no longer a medallion, right? You don't get the same money for it if you bring it to the pawn shop, right? It's not a medallion any longer. In the same way, all phenomena, their conventional nature of the phenomena, and their ultimate nature, their emptiness, the ultimate nature of phenomena is their emptiness of existing the way that they appear. They are of one nature. They're inseparable. But they cannot be perceived by ordinary beings like ourselves at the same time. Like at the beginning, I said the Buddha was engaged in this meditative equipoise on both truths, both the conventional and the ultimate at the same time. Only the Buddhists can do that. Fully enlightened being. Can perceive the two levels of truth, the conventional truth and the ultimate truth at the same time. So this fourfold profundity, this suk tong pao, tong ba ni suk so, sukle tongpa ni shen mayin. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is also not other than form. This is talking about this particular facet of understanding. If you really wanted to understand emptiness, this is something you have to come to grips with. Otherwise, if emptiness was something separate from the object, you would be able to understand it without, like, you could understand the emptiness of form without ever having realized the form. How could you call that the emptiness of form? You might just say, oh, there's something like emptiness, some ultimate truth that exists. It's not like that. Emptiness is always the emptiness of some conventional phenomena. Emptiness means the lack of a conventional phenomena's existing the way that it appears to the uneducated mind is somehow really, it's like there's some real essence there. All that appears to our mind are like appearances, even now that we think are so real, because you can touch your friend, you can eat your stracciatella ice cream, gelato. You know stracciatella? You're laughing. Do you know stracciatella? Great gelato. This is my favorite. What do you call it? My fantasy of great, you know, bliss is to have a big swimming pool filled with stracciatella ice cream, refrigerated swimming pool, with a gate around it to keep everyone else out. You know, stracciatella. If you've ever had stracciatella gelato, you should try it. It's really good. Have you ever had it? It's one little, not chocolate chips, but like, you know, these cheese things, so you do that with chocolate and it goes in the vanilla gelato. Maybe there's some other ingredients, which is very good. So it's not as though emptiness exists as an ultimate in and of itself. Emptiness is always the emptiness of something. Like the emptiness of a mirage, emptiness of a tree, emptiness of a person, emptiness of the self. And that those particular instances of emptiness are never separate. You can't separate them, like the two sides of a medallion. They can't be separated from the conventional thing that they are the emptiness of. Okay? So that's called a fourfold profundity sometimes in the commentaries. So what was he talking about? He was using form here. Why did he talk about form? Because of the five skandhas, the five aggregates, form is the first one. So he's just using that. Now he's going to talk about the other four aggregates. What are the other ones? Feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness, right? So then he says, deshindu, 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth line down, Joy, on page 280, about halfway through the page, beginning of the line, it says, deshindu, that means likewise, sorwa, feeling, duche, discrimination, duche, compositional factor, nampa shepa, nam, nampa shepa means consciousnesses, tongbao, are all empty. In the same way that I just explained about form, that's not exclusive to form, also feelings, if you investigate, they seem... So how do you experience feelings? Do you see feelings? And by feelings here, I mean, remember what I mean, the experience of pleasure, pain, or indifference, you know, neutral feeling. Do you see those feelings? No. Do you hear them? No. They might be associated with, you know, someone said, you might say, that's a good feeling, but that's, you're not... hearing the feeling, you're hearing some response to the person who had the feeling, right? Do you smell feelings? No. Taste them? No. Taste, you might say, well, maybe taste. You do have feelings when you taste, but feeling is different than the taste itself. And tactile sensations, although you might say those are feelings, tactile sensation of hot, cold, soft, smooth, those are not feelings. So feelings somehow are apprehended by your mind or by any of the senses. Any of the senses have within them their own experience of pleasure, pain, pain, or neutrality. That seems so real to us, and that motivates us to try to duplicate that feeling, to prolong that feeling if it's pleasurable, or if it's an unpleasurable, if it's a suffering feeling, an unpleasant feeling, we try to prevent it, stop it, put on salve or, you know, whatever would relieve that particular kind of pain. But it seems real to us. If we were to investigate that, something is appearing to our mind. The mind, just like form, to the mind, feeling is just an appearance. In the same way that form, visual form, is to our eye consciousness, an appearance that we think is real there. And we can sometimes we think we verify that. We reach out, we touch it, you say, yeah, there's real rock there, or there's a real tree there or something, real visual object. Also feelings, this very, very powerful, if you understand emptiness, the feelings that we so much long for are actually empty of the reality we attribute to them. Up till now, we may have never thought of that or experienced that, certainly. Besides visual forms, that may come as a shock, but feelings also are discriminations. This is good, this is bad, you know, so forth and so on. All these are that factor that is able to discriminate one thing to another that we might think of as a positive attribute of our consciousness. That activity of the mind is called a mental factor discrimination. That too might seem like something real, really findable there. It's functioning and acting. That too is an appearance to our mind which is empty of existing the way that it appears is really findable and substantially existent. Just a name we give to that appearance. Go back to the self. If you were to really watch how your mind acts when you've been offended, it seems like, you know, like, what do you mean? You know, you just talk, you know, you said that to me, you know, like pointing to yourself as though there's, your mind is assuming there's some me other than the body, other than the mind, some kind of controller, like a soul that's really there, that's been offended. Or when you feel great longing for something, you know, another friendship of another person, or embrace of someone, or the to, you know, great desire for scracciatella, or alcohol, or heroin, you know. There's a sense that that self is going to be the recipient of that pleasure. If you can meditate on the emptiness of the self, there's no self here, and there's no pleasure that you're longing for the way that your mind thinks. Something appears, what we call a dependent arising due to karma, you know, the appearance of scracciatella, the appearance of heroin, and also the appearance, once you inject the heroin, the appearance of relief, pleasure. Ah, at first, as we said the other day, it's just the replacing of one suffering, the irritation in your body, longing for that relief, replacing it with the suffering of heroin. It's not until the suffering of the heroin exceeds the suffering that you're relieving, the itch you're trying to, what does it say? He's got a monkey on his back. They talk to someone with alcohol, I guess. Monkey on his back also means heroin. Someone who's addicted, like there's something they're trying to satisfy. As soon as the suffering of the heroin exceeds that, what is that period called? Withdrawal or delirium tremens or something like that, when you start feeling the suffering of the heroin. There's no real pleasure there. So Avalokiteshvara says, besides form, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, all the other things, love, hate, all of these things that we think are real in our mind, they're all empty. And even consciousness itself, we'll talk about in the Mahamudra course, even consciousness itself is empty of inherent existence. the Dalai Lama has said, and the Buddha said, and not just the Dalai Lama, but I remember reading in one of his texts that I taught here many years ago, if you have an understanding of the emptiness of the mind, subsequent progress is in the spiritual path is very, can be very rapid. If you realize the emptiness of the mind. The mind is like the ultimate subject of everything, the thing that's experiencing all the phenomena that we know. If you understand the subject is empty of inherent existence, you have to think about it again. That would imply that all of the things it's apprehending are also empty of inherent existence. You don't have to prove each one of them individually. Just go back, the mind is empty of inherent existence. Something to keep in mind. So the fourfold profundity applied to form, but also applies to feeling. Feelings are empty. Emptiness is feeling, our feelings. Feelings are not other than emptiness. Emptiness are not other than feelings. You could replace the word form with feeling. Or you could also replace the word form with discrimination or compositional factors or the last aggregate, the fifth aggregate, consciousness. So that's talking about what's called the fourfold profundity. Then he says, Shariputra. Okay, listen. He's going to say more. Detar chutamshe tongpanite. Like that, all phenomena are emptiness. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. At the end of the seventh line, Joy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, at the end of the sixth line, the last letter, te. Tetar, the next line, eighth. Chutamshe tongpanite. So that says, like that, tetar, like that. Tar means like. Te means that. Chutamshe means all dharmas, all phenomena are just empty. So what that means is, in the state of having realized the emptiness of one thing, like the emptiness of this microphone transmitter, the emptiness of the self, or the microphone, the emptiness of the tree, you know, the emptiness of the infinity or the Lexus. Once you've realized one emptiness, you are in a meditative equipoise that's recognizing the ultimate nature of that thing, but there is no difference in apprehension. What are you apprehending at that time? A mere vacuity of inherent existence. The mere absence of some real substantial existence. That is the same experience of the emptiness of everything else. So before I said all emptinesses are individual, like the emptiness of the tree, the emptiness of the stracciatella, the emptiness of the person. They're never separated from their conventional phenomena. Yet, on the other hand, when you've realized one emptiness, that experience is the same experience as if you meditated on the emptiness of anything else, and also if you meditated on the emptiness of all things at one time. Like, say, the Buddha's mind that perceives, omniscient mind, perceives all phenomena, also knows all of them, that entirety, at one instant, are empty of the way that they're appearing to the mind. So he says, Detar chutamche tongpanite. So like that, all phenomena are empty. Seni mepa, they are without characteristic. I'm counting here, that's two. Unborn. You remember, you've ever heard that when people talk about higher Buddhist teachings, phenomena are unborn or uncreated? Uncreated. Not unborn like, what is that, the zombie movies, the undead? I'm not talking about something like that. They're not created. What does that mean? Aren't things created? Aren't sprouts? Don't sprouts grow? Aren't they created? Or, you know, don't they generate? Well, conventionally they are, but ultimately they are empty of existing the way that they appear as, you know, the process. Here is talking about processes also, and other kinds of things, not just the five aggregates. So he said, like that, all phenomena are empty, are just empty. They are without characteristics. They are unborn. They're unceased. Well, these phenomena do cease, don't they? You know, like for instance, when you overcome the delusions, you have a cessation of that delusion, but it doesn't, that cessation that your mind thinks of is something you want to gain in the future. Or someone was telling me about their maybe they don't listen on the tape sometimes. Someone was telling me about their in-law, their mother-in-law was all, and their mother, father-in-law always criticizing her in mind. I want this to cease. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could have the cessation of that, you know, all this criticism. Daughter-in-law was being criticized. So we might think of that cessation or the cessation of delusions as something, yeah, no, that's real, substantial, that's real existence. That also is empty. All phenomena, they have an inception, they have a period of abidance maybe, a period of disintegration, and a period of cessation. Even the cessation doesn't exist ultimately. So there's, so all phenomena are empty, without characteristic, unborn, unceased. Tima mepa, tima dandelwa. Tiwa mepa, kangla mebao. This is called the eightfold profundity. These eight things. And I don't have enough time to go into detail about all of that. We're just giving a little, like I mentioned at lunch today to some friends, when you hear some teachings for the first time, it's almost like painting some bare wood with a primer. And what do you even do? Even before the primer, sometimes you might put on some linseed oil or something to make the wood a little more, like the raw wood, a little more susceptible to having further layers of paint put on. So sometimes when we hear teachings, you shouldn't feel discouraged, like, there was something there, but I didn't understand anything, so I'm just going to forget about it. Don't worry. It's like some imprints are being put in your mind. It's like putting a primer. Later, when you hear Geshe-la or Lama Tsopa or the Dalai Lama or someone teach about emptiness, having just heard about these things and thought about them, what they say at that time would be like putting another layer of paint on, becomes a little more colorful, right? Maybe then when that dries, that's absorbed into the wood and into the previous layer. Then when you hear another teaching, you study it in more detail, that's when things will become more clear. So we're just going kind of like, this is our primer coat. So eightfold profundity. Then he says again, he addresses Shariputra. He says, Shariputra, detawena, therefore, tongpanila in emptiness. So what that means is, when a bodhisattva, or even a shravaka, meditates on emptiness, when it says in emptiness, that means in the state where the mind is realizing the emptiness, the mere vacuity, Detawena, tongpa nila, in emptiness, there is no form, sukme, sorwame, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. Like sometimes people take this out of context. Some non-Buddhist philosophers, or even some Buddhist philosophers, they say, oh, the Buddha said, there is no form, there is no feeling. There are no feelings. There are no discriminations. There are no compositional factors. There's no consciousness. It's like nothing exists. That's not what he said. It was prefaced with this word, in emptiness. Where was that? Detawena, tongpa nila, in emptiness. That means in the apprehension, when one is realizing, let's say, the emptiness of form, form does not appear, feelings do not appear, all that the mind knows is that mere vacuity, that mere certainty that there is, and in fact, you're not even thinking there is no inherently existent form. All that appears to the mind is a mere vacuity. No thinking, oh, this is emptiness, this is the emptiness of form, nothing like that. Just emptiness. There is no form, there's no feeling, no compositional factors, no consciousness, and so forth. Then he goes on. Nikme, there's no eye, there is no ear, naame, name, no nose, no tongue. Lume, no body, that means no body faculty. Yime, no mental consciousness faculty. So what does this mean? When it says no eye, it doesn't mean no eyeball. It's talking about something more subtle. When we see, in order for eye consciousness to function, there have to be three things that come together. Do you know? Have you heard before? There has to be an object. Let's say, we'll use eyesight as the example. So there has to be a visual object, shape or color. What else do you need to have eye consciousness?
The eye itself.
So we have to have what's called the eye faculty. Sometimes people think that means the eyeball. In a grosser sense, it refers more to the retina, and even more subtly, more specifically, to what in Western physiology we might call the, what, Laura, the rods and cones, the receptors within the retina that actually perceive intensity of light and discriminate colors and so forth. And even more subtly than that, a subtle matter within those rods and cones, which is the what when you delineate what the eye faculty is, it's though that substance, that subtle matter in the retina, in the rods and cones, if I'm using the right terminology, is there more things there that perceive color and shape?
No, rods and cones.
Rods and cones. And even not just those, that gross matter, some subtler matter that you can't perceive even with a microscope. That's the eye faculty. Ear faculty, within the, well, there's some chamber, there's a, like what's something called an anvil and a hammer or something. Within that, there's some little hairs kind of thing, not hairs, cilia, that within which the subtle ear faculty is. That's the actual ear faculty. Nose is a similar kind of thing within certain part, because not every part of your nose perceives smell. There's certain receptors within your nose. Tongue is more obvious. People do experiments. If you put sweet on certain spots of your tongue, you don't taste it. Other spots you do. There's certain receptors in your tongue, and it's not those that are the tongue faculty. Certainly for Buddhism, this piece of meat is not when it says no tongue, it doesn't mean this, it means no tongue faculty. It doesn't mean even the receptors, the gross receptors within the tongue, but even the subtle matter within them that can't be perceived, and no body faculty. You might think that that means that there's no skin or something where you feel. From Buddhist point of view, the body faculty pervades all the other organs, because if you stick if you get some dust in your eye, even your eye feels uncomfortable, right? So there's body, besides the fact this eyeball, somewhere back there is the eye faculty, within the eyeball itself, which is not the eye faculty, it also is pervaded by the body faculty. You can feel hot, cold. If you put something close to your eye, you can feel it's warm or something cold. And then it says no consciousness faculty. What's the faculty of consciousness, mental consciousness? Is it the brain? Like the organ? And rather than saying faculty, we say eye organ. Doesn't mean the eye, doesn't mean the retina, doesn't mean the rods and cones, but something more subtle within the rods and cones. That's the actual eye organ or eye faculty. Ear, we talked about everything. So what's the mental faculty or mental organ?
Thought.
Oh, you guys are too smart, but someone might say the brain. Come on, George. The brain is the mental organ. We think people always, especially science thinks, because of the activity, electrical activity emanating from the brain, correlating with mental activity, we think that the brain is somehow like the organ of the mind. From a Buddhist perspective, there is a connection between the brain, especially with short-term and long-term memory, but actual consciousness is of a different entity. Mental consciousness is of a different continuum than matter. The brain is made of matter. Consciousness is of a different continuum. It's formless. It has its own origin and continuity. You can't change matter into consciousness. You can't change consciousness into matter. So he said, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, blah, 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 blah. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no blah, 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 blah. Then, sukme, tame, dime, rome, rechame, chume de. So that means there is no visual form. We talked about there is no eye faculty. And also there's no objects of eye faculty. There's no shapes and colors. There's no visual form. There are no sounds. There are no odors. There are no tastes. Where am I? There are no tangible objects, objects of touch. There are no phenomena that are perceived by the mind. So again, you might say, what is that? There are smells. In fact, last night, there were apparently, the reason class was called off because there were smells in this room, right? Or odors, or we say, what do we use a different word for bad odors? Smells, yeah, that's smells. If it's nice, we say it's a fragrance, right? Or an odor or something. We have different names for things that are either pleasant or unpleasant. So we might think, this, from a Buddhist perspective, from the higher point of view of the Bodhisattva, those things are appearing to the nose consciousness in the same way that forms and other things appear to the eye consciousness. I can use the word appear. But they are empty of the reality that we are attributing to it. And like when we get real revulsion to some smell, ooh, bad, I got to get away from that. It's actually, if something is appearing, and due to your karma, its experience is, perhaps if it's unpleasant, its experience is as painful or unpleasant feeling within the nose consciousness. But it's empty of the inherent existence that we're attributing to it. So he ends that little sequence there. Then he goes on to say, do we have time? 8:30? This is the end. Oh, that's good. Halfway through. So maybe auspicious to, again, come back. And sometimes when the Dalai Lama, other lamas, when they're teaching something, they don't get to the end, and they'll say, oh, that's good. Because they'll, make a wish that this group, all of us, here, where there's some reason we, in previous lives, we must have created some karma to be interested in this subject and just to be here today. So maybe we create karma again, maybe this lifetime, sometime in the future, to finish the Heart Sutra. But I don't want to keep over the time because a lot of you have a lot of things to do. And we did, I've gone into some detail. Had I done a little more, just a quick primer, we could have finished the whole thing, but I gave you a little bit for this first half, a little bit more. Maybe those first sections where the main thing was when Avalokiteshvara is telling Shariputra, hey, listen, Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, any son or daughter of the lineage, man or woman, doesn't matter, who wants to practice the perfection of wisdom, they should think of it like this. Not all these words are in the sutra, but the implication is they shouldn't meditate only on the emptiness of the self, like you guys do. You should meditate on even the basis upon which the self is labeled. Those parts that you think are substantially existent, they are also empty of inherent existence. Even the parts of those are empty of inherent. There is form and its emptiness. This is another concept that comes in here, the fourfold profundity. Form and its emptiness are not different entities. They are conceptually different. They can't be perceived at the same time. Like you can't see, unless you have a mirror maybe, you can see the head and the tail at the same time. You're looking at the head and say, oh, I see the tail at the same time. Not like that. One mind can't perceive ultimate reality for ordinary being, can't perceive the emptiness and the conventional phenomena at the same time. Only an enlightened mind, a Buddha, can perceive that. Even the highest 10th level bodhisattvas, if they want to meditate on the emptiness of the clock, they meditating on emptiness, they can rise from that meditation on emptiness in less than a finger snap and perceive the clock, then go back into the emptiness of the clock, but they can't perceive both at the same time. But at the time of Buddhahood, that limitation is eliminated and they can perceive the clock, the conventional clock, I don't mean the one that we think here that's inherently existent, but just the conventionally existent clock without the imposition of Santa Claus on it, right? They can perceive both the conventional and ultimate nature of the same time. So I think that's good. Okay. So thanks for coming. Thanks for your interest in emptiness, which is, this can really save us. I mean, if you realize, if you're trying to purify, do purification meditation, like Vajrasattva or something, or any kind of meditation where you're applying this, you know, the four appointed forces, especially regret, and you think, when I did that, maybe I stole money from my mom, or I said bad words to this, or I had, you know, did something bad, and you feel guilt, realize the person that you imagine that did that never existed. At that time, you believe there was a real self doing that. This is one of the most powerful ways to purify our negative karma. It doesn't mean that there will be no karmic consequences. The fact that you never existed the way you thought at that time, that doesn't negate that there will be karmic consequences. But realizing that, you can let go and feel real regret because you know that there will be some karmic consequence of that. But realizing the emptiness of that, of the person, the action that you thought you did, also, just the name, something that appears to your mind conceptually, actually there was no action of killing or lying or stealing or sexual misconduct or whatever. Just names, appearances to your mind. Such a relief to the mind if you understand that. And you can develop some confidence that you can really purify these things. So let's just do what I jokingly say. You know, there's what I mentioned in the class the other day. There's a ritual that the lamas could do when they go through the villages on the yak. The people bring out their tanka or their rosary, say, oh, bless this. And the lama doesn't have time to go into their room and do all these rituals. So they have a little ritual that's so short he could memorize and do it on the back of the yak. They say consecration on the back of a yak. So we're going to do a dedication on the back of a yak. Just very quickly. Think that this evening we've created some virtuous karmic instincts in our mind that will definitely ripen within cyclic existence on ourself, our own continuum. Whatever way they ripen, may they always bring about our continued spiritual development for the welfare of others, whatever, maybe we become more kind, more patient, more loving, compassionate, and wise due to these merits, up until the time that we actually achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, due to these merits that we've created tonight. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Maybe we say that was Heart Sutra on the back of a yak.